In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, Congress took the first step this week that could lead to a potential ban on the popular app TikTok. We speak with national security specialist and former Commerce Department official, Nazak Nakhadr, about what could be next. Then, a conversation with data specialist Ken Block about his new book, Disproven, on his hiring by the Trump campaign to investigate 2020 election voter fraud claims. And iCivic CEO Luis Dubé joins us to discuss Civic Learning Week, which was this past week, and the importance of civics education.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now, we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
We begin with a discussion about the future of TikTok in the U.S., with the House this week passing legislation that could lead to a ban on the popular app.
At our table this morning is Nazak Nakhadr. She was a former Trump administration, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Commerce, here to talk about this debate in Washington over what to do about TikTok. The House approved this legislation, 352-65, an overwhelming bipartisan support. Is this significant?
It's enormously significant. Given the scope of TikTok users and how debated this issue has been over the last several years, it's really heartwarming and really encouraging to see the government come together on a bipartisan basis, being on the exact same page about the threats posed to U.S. national security. Absolutely.
You call it heartwarming. Why? And a threat?
I think in today's era, we tend to all over-politicize issues, and it's really nice when people, in instances where people can put partisanship aside and really come together to address national security threats, which goes to your second question, is this a threat? Absolutely. Director Wray, FBI Director, Director Haynes, from the Director of Intelligence, have been incredibly vocal about the threats that TikTok pose. And when you look at how much that they've been issuing the warning, it's really unprecedented. We don't see anything like that normally. So we really need to heed their warnings and understand that these apps hosted by foreign adversary nations really do pose a national security threat. And then there's going to be much more to unpack there, I'm sure.
Yeah, dig into the threat, because it's interesting, because our viewers were saying they were surprised that lawmakers would move quickly. You know, in that it passed a committee last week, they moved quickly in the House to put it on the floor, and that you saw this overwhelming bipartisan support, 352, and they can't support other legislation, but they can come together behind this. So one viewer saying, what's going on? What's behind this?
Really, there's nothing nefarious behind it. I think what FBI Director Wray has been doing quite effectively is he's kept his foot on the gas pedal. There are threats to using TikTok is emblematic of the apps hosted by foreign adversary nations, right? So he's kept his foot on the pedal to the extent that Congress can no longer ignore. People vote their members in Congress to protect national security interests. It is literally impossible for the American public to be deeply educated on every single issue that's before Congress. That's why they have elected representatives to make those difficult, difficult decisions for them. And so the U.S. government, the executive branch, Director Wray, Director Haynes, have emphasized the issue so much that it is inconvenient to ignore. Right now, what are the national security threats? It's incredible the capabilities that technology, current technology, unleashes. If you use an app that's hosted by a foreign adversary, so we know the media, the FBI director has talked about surveillance capabilities. We know about surveillance. They drop code. The app can drop code into your phone. If your microphone looks like it's off, it could actually be on, record everything you're doing, listen to everything you're doing, monitor all of your keystrokes, et cetera. Then there's this risk of pushing out algorithms that push out content that's destructive, right? Destructive to children. Europe has actually had two cases where they fined TikTok for pushing out content to children that was inappropriate. So that kind of threat. But even more so, in addition to all that, because I think the average user is going to say, yeah, but I'm consenting to all this, right? I'm consenting to TikTok to have this. Yeah, and I know that even if my mic is off, they might be listening to it, but I'm not really saying anything important. There's another risk there. How do these apps connect to anything? They're connecting through software to the telecommunications infrastructure. And code is communicated with the telecommunications infrastructure. So malicious code is also able to be transferred into the telecommunications infrastructure. So you've got individual risks to individual people, risks to populations, as a foreign adversary government is collecting massive amounts of data on populations in the United States, demographics, regions, et cetera, and also risks to the telecommunication infrastructure, which we depend on. It's pretty grave. It's very serious.
Is this effectively a ban? Because we read from David Singer's news analysis today in the New York Times that the Chinese government has control over the algorithm. So if you force a sale, he says, it's like a U.S. company buying a Ferrari without its famed engine. You won't get the algorithm.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It's an excellent point. ByteDance has repeatedly said, remember, ByteDance and TikTok, ByteDance, the parent company, they've been before the U.S. government for a number of years now through a review of the national security risks. ByteDance has repeatedly said over and over again publicly that it will not divest TikTok, right? So the legislators know that. They know that ByteDance isn't going to have a sudden about face. That's why the legislation has built-in suspenders that says basically you're supposed to divest because your ownership of TikTok is a significant national security risk. And if you do not divest, then we can prohibit the app providers, web hosting services from providing your app. And we're also requiring that users, prior to the prohibition or prior to the fines, if users need to obtain their information from you, you are supposed to give that back to the users, what you've been collecting on them, right? Belts and suspenders, that's very important.
What is the likelihood that this company would give that user data back?
Nothing. They will not give the user data back. They'll do it in a very insignificant way. Of course, they don't want problematic fingerprints on anything. But that's when the U.S. government is going to go in and with the app providers and the web hosting services, prohibit them from offering any upgrades or any further provision of the app.
That was national security specialist and former Commerce Department official, Nazak Nakhater. Next, data scientist Ken Block talks about his new book, Disproven, about his work with the 2020 Trump campaign to investigate claims of voter fraud.
Mr. Block, why did the former president campaign hire you, and what did they hire you to do?
Yeah, it was sort of a two-part project. The original request was for me to look for evidence of voter fraud in the swing states in the 2020 election. I was looking for evidence of deceased voters and for voters who voted twice, once in a swing state and once in some other state. Very quickly, a matter of just a day or two after my contract was signed, the campaign attorneys who were doing their due diligence asked me to begin evaluating claims of voter fraud that were coming into the campaign from everywhere, from all over the country, from amateurs looking at data to lawyers whose names we all recognize making claims of fraud. And when those claims involved data, the campaign asked me to evaluate them and tell them if they were correct or not. And in every circumstance, they were false.
You write in the book, the contract was signed on November 5th, 2020. I had no idea then how finding so little would lead to so much. You sign a contract with the Trump campaign on that day, November 5th, 2020. How long did you work for them?
It's about 35 days, 35 of what is honestly, I can say, some of the craziest days I've had. Yeah.
35 days.
Yeah.
In 35 days, did you have access to all the data that you needed access to determine whether or not there was fraud?
So it's a very nuanced answer that I'm going to give you. The answer is I had access to all of the data that was available at that time. So I had full access to the data that the RNC had available. What's very interesting about voter data is that no state makes available to anybody who voted in person inside that 30-35 day window. You get all the mail ballot information that you can process, but for some reason, the in-person votes are not there. So that's a large chunk of the vote that wasn't available. However, all that information is made available usually by January or February after the election. And just because that data wasn't available to me at that period of time, because nobody has gone through it since and determined, wow, there was actually a bunch of fraud, that is not an impactful, meaningful problem that I had when I was working in November of 2020.
Well, then explain how you could go back to the Trump campaign and say, there is no voter fraud in those 35 days.
Well, so I didn't say there was no voter fraud. What I told them there wasn't enough voter fraud to matter, and that's an important distinction. Mm-hmm. We did find some dead voters. We did find some duplicate voters. But the numbers were far less than the thousands, many thousands that were necessary inside the swing states. And I was very transparent as we discussed the challenges with having access to some data and not having access to other data. I can pretty confidently say that the Trump attorneys that I reported to, specifically Alex Cannon, who was my main contact, had a lot of confidence in the work that I was doing, in the fact that I was being as thorough as I was, and I was probably numbing his brain with how much information I was educating him about voter data and the processes that I was going through. I know he trusted my results, and he communicated very thoroughly to Mark Meadows at the end of the day that the campaign looked extraordinarily hard at not only looking for fraud, but evaluating everyone else's claims of fraud. And we found nothing that rose to the level of changing an election result that would survive legal scrutiny in court.
You then write this book, Disproven. Did you go back after those 35 days and do a more thorough look at the data after more became available?
I didn't personally go back and take a look at it. I do. Some of the data is all the data is available at this point now. And for all of the people who had such a strong vested interest in looking, for sure there were many eyes that looked at this data after the fact, and nobody has gone through the data and made any determination that contradicts what I had done within the 30 days. The other thing that's important to remember here, to file a claim in court, you can't file a claim based on data that doesn't exist. You can only work with what's out there right now. And right now, it was mail ballots, and there were plenty of mail ballots to look at, tens of millions of them. And having gone through all of those, look, my job was to find it. And if there was massive voter fraud, I wanted to be the guy to do it, right? I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary thing if you were able to have a finding like that. But I also wasn't going to ruin my personal and professional reputation by delivering results that I would be humiliated with in court. So in the contract, I put a sentence in there that said, I'm going to deliver you findings that will stand up in court. And unfortunately, there was just nothing that rose to that.
Who hired you and why?
So it was Alex Cannon. I don't know why.
You still to this day don't know why?
I still do not know.
How did he find you?
I don't know. And you have to remember, in those 35 days, there was no time to talk about that sort of thing. I mean, it was action-packed from 5 in the morning until sometimes all night.
What is a data specialist?
What is a data specialist? So I own a software engineering company. We specialize in large database applications. I participated in and architected the country's first online debit card system for food stamps for the state of Texas. We do a lot of work in the gaming industry. So wherever there's lots of transactions and lots of data, that's where I do a lot of my work. And data mining for waste and fraud is something that I've always enjoyed doing, and I think it's important to do. And we've looked at, over the years, food stamp fraud and Medicare fraud, that sort of thing.
Who did you talk to during these 35 days from the Trump campaign, and who did you not talk to?
Well, the simple answer to that is almost all of my communications were with Alex Cannon. As we set up the framework for how I was going to do this work, he told me that he was going to keep my identity and my company's identity closely held. He didn't want the White House to know who was doing the work, because he wanted us to be unbiased, and he wanted us to be shielded from political pressure. He wanted us to be shielded from people insisting on a certain set of results, because you can't, that's not what works for landing you in court with a successful court case. So it was really just Alex, from anyone within the campaign, it was him.
So when you spoke to Alex Cannon, where did that communication go from Alex? Once you spoke to him, who did he talk to?
So at the time, I had no idea, but with the January 6th transcripts, I learned that obviously he was talking to other upper-level campaign attorneys, and then most notably the fact that he delivered the news to Mark Meadows that the campaign was unable to find any fraud that mattered that could have changed the election result.
And that information went to the former president, correct?
After everything, there were news reports that Mark Meadows told Jack Smith's investigators that he took that information into the Oval Office.
Who did you not talk to?
Just
Which
about
lawyers?
Everybody else. Oh, I mean, really, just about everybody else. Alex Cannon was my, pretty much, even before I said hello to my wife in the morning, I was talking to Alex Cannon first, and it was pretty much the last conversation I had during the day as well.
What about the lawsuits brought forward by Rudy Giuliani and other lawyers?
Yeah, so I saw claims that I can confidently say came through Sidney Powell. She was helping to push a mathematical theory they were trying to apply to the entire state of Pennsylvania to prove voter fraud, and that was wrong. I saw a claim that I've been able to piece together, I'm pretty sure came from John Eastman, with 16,000 claimed duplicate votes in Nevada. It was about 16, right? So this was a pattern. All the numbers were hyperinflated because the people who did the analysis didn't understand what they were looking at, and they didn't understand how to make sure they weren't making errors in uniquely identifying a person. Consistently across the board, there was a lack of understanding of what people were looking at, and that's why most of the claims were false.
That was Ken Block, data scientist and author of the new book, Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign. Finally, iCivics CEO Luis Dubé discusses the history of the organization, founded by the late Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and the importance of civics education.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about iCivics? What's your mission and your history?
So iCivics was founded by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. She had a real vision for how important civic education was for our country. She herself, if you remember, had served in legislature. She had been a civil servant. She had been in government, and she was then appointed to be a judge. She had worked also as a private lawyer. So she had experienced this issue from a lot of different places. She understood how interrelated these things are, the public and legislature and the judiciary. All of that is one system of governance, and it relies on people to do it. It's called self-governance. And she realized that there had been less and less civic education being done since she was a child to when she began this, which is after she stepped down from the court in 2006. And in 2009, she incorporated iCivics and said, okay, we got to do it differently. Got to do it better. Got to put kids in the center of this, and we got to make this important. And she went on and became the standard bearer for the cause of civic education as a requirement to a healthy democracy. And that's the mission that we've been on. She has We lost her, unfortunately for us, in December last year, but she had been unable to serve the nation for many years, and we have taken up her mantle. iCivics is now the largest civic education site in the country, and we have assembled a coalition of 330 members, organizational members, and we make the case that we need to invest in civic education. The situation as it stands now is really difficult and dangerous for our country. We do not have sufficient or quality civic education. It's the least invested in subject in schools. And, you know, we see the results.
You mentioned Justice O'Connor. She testified before Congress back in 2012 about the importance of civics education as well as iCivics. Let's hear a portion.
We have learned to our dismay that our American students, when tested on math and science, are not doing as well as students of an equivalent age from many other countries. And I think that distresses us because our country has been pretty advanced in math and science, and we don't want to see our students lag behind. And that has promoted an effort to increase education efforts in those areas, and it has resulted in the dropping of civics courses. I mean, there are only so many hours in a day, and schools have to concentrate on something, and they've tended to maybe do more math and science and less on civics. And I would just like to be sure that we continue to teach some civics to students as they go through. My own concentration has been at the middle school level, because by then the brain is formed and the young people are eager to learn, they're receptive and they can get it, and it's not too early to start. So I think it's important, and students want to know how government works, how their city works, their county, their state, the nation. They want to be part of it.
So can you talk a little bit more about iCivics, how you all are funded, and who specifically you're working with on a regular basis?
First of all, it's lovely to hear her voice, and she's right on, as usual. And so we have picked up where Justice O'Connor left off in her clip. We have formed a set of policy team to try to advocate to have more civic education in the school curriculum. While iCivics started at the middle school, we now work at the high school level and at the elementary level. So we believe that civic education can be a real force for good for our country if we invest in it. And I think this problem that Justice O'Connor pointed to, which is that by pushing the importance of one discipline at the expense of another, which is completely understandable, it really doesn't work because these things reinforce each other. And at the core of it, every child will be a community member when he comes out of high school. They may not all go to college, but we will all have to live together. And as Justice O'Connor pointed out, they want to know how to behave, how to be, how to solve problems in community, let alone at the state or federal level. So that's what we try to do, to prepare students with knowledge, skills, and disposition to solve common problems in community.
You know,
so, yeah.
Can you give us sort of a base level understanding of what we mean when we talk about civics education and how it's changed over time, as Justice Connor was referencing?
Yeah, so Justice O'Connor referenced her upbringing where she got much more civics. There was a government class that was required of everyone. Everybody remembers Schoolhouse Rock from a certain age, and they can sing it. That started to fritter away. There's different versions of it, but sometime around the 60s, the investment in civic education started to decrease the time in the classroom, which is really the best measure for whether students are getting civics or not. Was clearly down. We're down to 10 minutes at elementary school for social studies. That's per week, and that's really low. And it's not possible to provide a high quality civic education in that little of time.
That was Luis Dubé, CEO of the civics education organization, iCivics. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.